When pirates have hijacked a ship, when a criminal gang has kidnapped someone, when an entire company's future is being held to ransom from a cyber attack, Scott Walker is the person who gets called in. Scott spent over 10 years as a kidnap for ransom negotiator and has successfully negotiated more than 300 such incidents using the principles he shares in his best-selling book, Order Out of Chaos. The New York Times called his book a masterclass in communication excellence, and I couldn't agree more. Today, Scott trains leaders and their teams to negotiate better deals, resolve conflict, and thrive under pressure. In this fascinating conversation, Scott explains how to regulate your emotions under pressure, how to negotiate successfully when the stakes are high, what to avoid in a negotiation, what to do when it stalls, and much more. Enjoy this episode with one of the world's foremost experts on negotiation. Scott, welcome to Speak Like a CEO.
Thank you for having me. It is great to be here to have this conversation with you.
Oh, absolutely. I was really looking forward to this. So where does this podcast find you today?
It finds me alive and well, which is always a good start.
Yes.
and just preparing to go on a US-wide book and keynote speaking tour next week, which I'm looking forward to. Yeah.
And that is because of the US release of your book, Order Out of Chaos, which is fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, it came out in the UK last year and worldwide, and then just recently in the US. So looking forward to, you know, just having conversations with lots of people and, looking to help people be able to negotiate better.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a negotiation communications book, but obviously it's your unique take on it because of your personal background. So I wanted to ask you, how did you become a kidnap for ransom negotiator?
Well, yeah. It wasn't like at school, you know, you have the careers advice where do you want to be a teacher or, a doctor or something, or a lawyer. They never said to me, Scott, do you want to be a kidnapper for ransom negotiator? Fully enough. So I kind of fell into it. It's not one that you kind of see advertised, really. And usually the people who do it, it's their second or third career. And for me, I was a police officer, I was a detective at Scotland Yard for 16 years, where I got into that line of work. And then when I left the police, I went into the private sector, where it is huge business. And then I spent over 10 plus years doing that and really learning how people think, feel and act the way they do, particularly in times of uncertainty and stress. And crisis and change, and how they can overcome that and work through those adversity and difficult situations.
Yeah. And a few years ago, you made a career change again, and now you're in the private sector.
Yeah. So I left all that behind, although still occasionally advise on kidnappings and other forms of negotiation. But now I just take all that learning. Do you know what, Oliver? I was surprised, and I wasn't surprised, but over the hundreds of cases, I saw themes and patterns about what made people think, feel and act. How do people respond and navigate these crises, these challenges, and come through the other side? And there was such a big crossover in everyday business life as well in people's personal lives. And I just took all that knowledge and applied it to the world of business. And so now I take those tools and techniques. Ultimately, it's about having better conversations when it counts, so people can master their communication, learn how to influence and persuade, and to resolve that conflict and have those difficult conversations.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask, but how do you negotiate with pirates and hostage takers? Because those are the stories you tell in the book. And of course, when you start the book and you start reading about pirates, it's like, oh my God, this is fascinating.
Yeah, you think, okay, Scott, what is negotiating with pirates, kidnappers, hostage takers, terrorists got to do with me in the business world?
Yeah.
Well, when you think about it, the high stakes,
yep.
There's heightened emotions, egos play a role. There's some really specific measurable outcomes. There's multiple parties and stakeholders. There's usually some kind of outside or external interference. And there's no difference between how I've just painted that in the boardroom or in the corporate sector as dealing with kidnappers. And at the end of the day, remember, kidnappers are just businessmen looking to get a good deal.
A businessman looking. That's an interesting take I hadn't heard before.
And if you think about it as well, that there are three elements to negotiation. You've got to be able to master what the other side, the party, is doing and where they're coming from and their issues and concerns. Your own side, your own team. And then the third element is yourself, your own emotional state and mindset. And that applies whether or not you're dealing with your teenage kids, in a mergers and acquisitions, or it's the release of hostages. And what drives those three elements really is, or are, you've got to be able to problem solve and gather information. And then crucially, and this is where most people will skip over, is the developing and building relationships. Because if I don't take the time to build those relationships, then yes, we may get a deal once or twice. But I want, you know, if you're a potential client of mine, Oliver, I want to be able to get you for life, a client for life. And the only way I can do that is by really developing and establishing those relationships. And as I said, that applies no matter who you're negotiating with.
Yeah. So talk us through some of the tactics and methods you've applied when negotiating in these high-stakes situations.
Well, first of all, as I said, it's, you've got to be able to go in there, okay, we need to solve a problem, but the challenge comes is if we try and solve that problem too quickly. Because first of all, we need to really understand, okay, what is going on for the other side? I can't influence somebody unless I already know what influences them. This is not about finding common ground. I mean, that's the biggest load of, in my opinion, biggest load of BS you can have in terms of negotiation. Hey, we've got to find some kind of link of commonality. It's, yeah, I had nothing in common with kidnappers.
Mm-hmm.
Yet if I failed, people died. So it focused the mind on, actually, I need to go beyond finding the fact that we like the same football team or whatever it is, and yeah, actually really delve into the heart of it. And what is at the heart of every decision we make? Our emotions. Mm-hmm. We make decisions emotionally and then we look to justify them rationally afterwards. And the neuroscientist Jill Bolt Taylor beautifully articulates that, you know, we're feeding creatures that think, not thinking creatures that feel. So we're designed to be driven by emotions. Now, here's the thing. There's no agreed definition of what an emotion is, but I'm sure we all know it when we feel it. Yeah. And so what I'm saying here really is that to succeed in any form of negotiation is you've got to be able to identify and call out and overcome those emotions. Because, you know, I'm sure you've done plenty of negotiation training in the past, as indeed listeners to this podcast would have done in some kind of management program. And some of the old school thinking is well, you've got to separate the person from the problem. You know, mm-hmm. Let's bring some kind of logical, rational thought process to this. Yet that doesn't work. Yes, it may work if you're buying a car, but if you're talking about the real negotiations, the real conversations that count, the only way you're going to succeed there is by looking that the person is part of the negotiations. So we need to be able to, first of all, identify and regulate our own emotions about what's showing up. But crucially to know, okay, well, what's the underlying emotion or the need or the driver behind the other side and what they need to get from this? And until you do that, you're not going to get that long-term deal.
Yeah. And I think the issue is that a lot of our emotions, and maybe the other side's emotions as well, they hinder an agreement that serves both sides. It's probably the same with pirates, teenagers, and in the business context, that what I may feel in the moment is not going to be conducive to a positive outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing to remember is that emotions drive all behavior. They can make us frustrated and dissatisfied, as well as inefficient and ineffective, if we allow that emotional hijack. Let's keep in that kind of world. You know, we get hijacked by our own emotions or those of other people if we're not careful. Yet the number one skill, if there's only one thing that listeners take away from this today, is you've got to be able to emotionally self-regulate and yes. really develop that sensory acuity. You know, imagine you've got a radar, an emotional radar, that you're about to sit down across the table in a really important business negotiation with your kids, whomever, and you've got to be able to be on alert. You've got to be able to be aware of, okay, what is really showing up for me now? Am I feeling a little tense, a little frustrated? How's the other side coming across? And if we can't then identify and call them out, if we can't label those emotions, they're like that proverbial elephant in the room, and they just get in the way of coming to a good deal. But like a lot of things, it requires practice and discipline. It's like going to the gym. You don't go, hey, I've identified what's driving Oliver here, and then that's a tick box exercise. It's a constant, never-ending process, and the more you can do it, the easier it becomes.
Yeah, and it's in that pause between the trigger and my reaction to it, right, that I essentially decide the outcome of a negotiation or maybe a relationship. Because if I just follow my emotions, like, you know, just being triggered by them, that's, again, that's not conducive to a positive outcome, right? We need to learn how to pause and reflect and, you know, go into our system two mode and rationalize or think rationally about what's going to happen. Is that a fair description?
It is. And imagine there's a seesaw, you know, from a children's playground. On one side of the seesaw, you've got objective, rational, logical, common sense thinking and behavior. And on the other end, you've got anxiety, stress, overwhelm, high emotion. And what happens is people try and balance out the objective, rational thinking without reducing or lowering the anxiety, stress, and overwhelm. A classic everyday example is you're in the supermarket, you're in the store, and you see the toddler demanding some chocolate or some sweets. And the adult with them will go, no, you can't have that because you're going to have your dinner when you get home. And then what does the toddler do? They have a paddy, they have a tantrum, because they can't hear, physically, their brains can't hear the logical, rational thinking, because their anxiety, stress, overwhelm, high emotion hasn't been dealt with. And the same applies in the world of business. And so you're right, when we get that trigger, when we get that stimulus, we can then control. In fact, that's the only thing we really do control in the history of our life, really, is how do we deal with that? Do we react in an emotional knee-jerk fashion? Or ideally, do we respond? Do we pause? Do we take a split second and go, right, what is showing up for me here? I can feel that in my stomach, in my shoulders. I can feel that tension. Right, I need to ride the wave. You know, I call this the immediate action drill.
Yeah.
This is, you have 90 seconds, 2 minutes, where you get the cortisol, the adrenaline pumping through your body. You know, you'll go on social media and you'll read a post that just triggers the living daylights out of you. Or you're in the corporate setting and there's a colleague who just really winds you up, or an ego-driven boss or client that's not sticking to their terms of the agreement. And you just want to shout at them. You want to punch them on the nose. You want to do whatever. But in that moment, it's like, right, let me just ride the wave so I don't say or do something stupid I'm going to later regret. And then once that has subsided, once you can focus on feeling the feeling and dropping the story behind that, then you've giving yourself that space to then ask better questions, such as, okay, what am I missing here? Or how else could I look at this? Or what's the opportunity here? Or how could I really help this person? Which you wouldn't have been able to ask if you'd been caught up in that high, intense, emotional overwhelm.
You mentioned or alluded to empathy, and you obviously write in the book about empathy and the importance of it and understanding what's going on in the other person. And I wondered, from your perspective, what's the difference between empathy, sympathy, and compassion? These tend to be used quite interchangeably, but they're actually different concepts, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. We imagine a sliding scale. You've got pity, say, on the far left.
Yeah.
Which really doesn't help anybody, really. And you got sympathy, moves on to sympathy, where you're starting to take on the emotions, the pain, the feelings of the other person, which again isn't really going to help you in terms of negotiation or supporting somebody. And then you kind of enter the realm of empathy. And empathy is a doing word. It's a verb. Mm-hmm. You do empathy, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not necessarily something that the other person feels. They will feel rapport, they will feel trust, they will feel connection with you if you do empathy, if you empathize with them. And what empathy really is, it's you being able to demonstrate your understanding of what is going on for them. How are they seeing and interpreting the situation, the deal on the table, the world around them? And by doing that, it really knocks down barriers, and it really makes the other person feel seen, heard, and understood. And that's really the holy grail of what we're looking for here in any form of negotiation. And just remember, negotiation is simply a conversation with a purpose.
Yeah.
And that's all it is. And in every conversation that counts, if I can get the other person to feel seen, heard, and understood by empathizing, by validating where they're at, even if I get it wrong, that's okay, because I'm making the effort. And they will either correct me or whatever, but they will go, hey, do you know what? Scott is really doing his best here to see things from my perspective.
Yeah. Be seen, heard, and understood. I think that's a really good guideline. And what can we do if a negotiation stalls?
Yeah, pretty much most, if not all, of my previous negotiations, there's been something that's gone wrong, not according to plan, stalled, two steps backwards. It's just part and parcel of it. But you can minimize that from happening, or you can mitigate against the challenges that come with that through the preparation that you do. Okay, so there's two stages to this. There's one, the preparation, which I'll go through, and then I'll articulate, okay, what to do in the moment. First of all, as part of your preparation, is remember your ABCs. Okay, and I learned this on day one of detective training at Scotland Yard, which was assume nothing, believe nothing, and check and clarify everything.
That's great.
And by not assuming, but by bringing more curiosity than assumption to the table, you're going to kind of start to think, okay, well, what else is on play here? What might get in the way? Where is this person really coming from? I'm not really going to believe what I'm hearing. I'm going to want to challenge, or not necessarily challenge, I want to clarify and verify things. Okay, so we're working off facts really here. And then it's moving on to what I call the bunch of fives as part of the preparation. Bunch of fives, imagine like the palm of your hand. And you want to think of the five top challenges, questions, issues, threats, demands, problems that the other side might throw into the mix. They might levy against you. They may try and jeopardize the deal, or put a spanner in the works, use whatever analogy you want, a metaphor you want to use. And that bunch of fives, by doing that, along with your ABCs, it just means if it does happen, you can go, hey, we've planned for this. We know we've tried to avoid it, but it's happened. And actually, we've got a plan about what we're going to say and do if this happens. And what that does, it gives you more confidence and courage and certainty in how you approach the negotiation, which then minimizes the amount of things that are likely to go wrong and to stall the negotiation. But if you do hit that bump, the obstacle that you've covered, you can go, well, actually, we now know how to resolve it because you've thought it through. But if it's one that perhaps isn't in the in your bunch of fives, it's just about asking some better questions.
Yeah.
Okay, so you could say you and I are trying to do a business deal here and we're suddenly stalling on price. You know, you've said, actually, Scott, this is just too expensive, even though you've never mentioned it before. Which is unlikely, actually, because most stalling in negotiations, most obstacles, you can kind of spot, they kind of telegraph themselves way out if you're really listening and paying attention. But if this is completely left field, you go, actually, well, how do you propose we work through this? You know, you want to kind of put it back onto them, get them to do the heavy lifting, use really wide open what and how questions that encourage that dialogue. And see where you take it from there. But I think it's you, often most of them will get signposted that they're coming, these problems. But if they don't, it's keeping your cool, remember, your emotions, your self-regulation, your sensory acuity, thinking, okay, are they just trying to pull a fast one here? Because I remember on quite a lot of negotiations with kidnappers, we'd agree the ransom money, the ransom payment, so it'd all get bagged up, we're about to go and drop it off at the ransom point, and they'll go, yes, and we want 6 Rolex watches, 2 satellite phones, and 5 iPads. And you'd be like...
That's random.
And they'd be like, no. It's like the 11th hour sabotage. Well, we haven't got a deal then. And it's like, no, don't be silly. but what we used to do to prevent that from happening, and you can do this in business, is as you're starting to agree the terms of the deal, you can kind of sense or you can ask questions to make sure that actually there's going to be no 11th hour surprises. So... you know, it could be a question such as, what do you see could get in the way right at the very end here? What is an 11th hour distraction that we want to try and avoid? Because then if they go, oh, no, we're good. There's nothing that's going to get in the way. Then psychologically, subconsciously, they're less likely to then put a spanner in the works later on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense because they'd say, well, why didn't you mention it before when I ask about it?
Exactly.
And it puts you in a weaker position for sure.
Yeah.
I wonder, I mean, if a negotiation stalls, should you ever split the difference?
I've heard that line before somewhere. well, not really because, okay, say there were 6 hostages taken. Okay, tell you what, kidnappers, we'll just take 3. Okay, we'll split the difference. We only want to pay you half the money you want, and so we'll just take 3 of the hostages and you can do what you like with the other 3.
Yeah.
And I'm being a bit facetious there, but the point I'm making is I wanted to come up with a framework, a negotiation framework and tools and techniques, which is what I put in the book, around what will work in any and every situation, whether or not it's with your kids, a really tense business deal, kidnappers, not just some academic, logical-based negotiation theory and framework that has been bandied around that doesn't work in all situations.
Yeah.
Because I think if you're going to split the difference, you're leaving money on the table, you could damage your reputation, you're not going to get actually what you're entitled to in a way, and it could be a better deal if you just walk away. And again, I always say to people is, don't be frightened to walk away from a bad deal.
Yeah. And often to get to an agreement, someone walks, right, and then comes back. I mean, really in high-stakes situations, that is often the case.
Yeah, what we're saying is that you want to always aim for the cooperation and collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, if you have to walk away, you have to walk away. Because ultimately, you want both sides to an agreement, to feel as if they've got the best deal. If you think, do you know what? We've been either taken advantage of here, or it's not as good a deal as we want. Well, actually, you've shot yourself in the foot there, and you could have avoided that.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I wonder, negotiations, what should people look out for? Body language, voice, what do you pay attention to?
Well, the way to, first of all, pay attention is by listening properly. Not, I don't mean the surface level, listening for the gist of what they're saying, or looking to rebut them, or wait to you finish so I can now, it's now my turn to speak, which a lot of us do. And so I call it level 5 listening. This is where you're listening for almost what is not being said. So you're listening for tone of voice. You're listening for congruency in what is being said and how it's being said. And if you do pay attention, you can, the other person is going to tell you consciously or subconsciously through how they communicate what their real needs are here. Listen to the words they use, the words they don't use, and you can determine actually they, you know what, being in control, saving face, significance, certainty, they're all really important to this person because of how they've articulated this particular deal. Or actually, this is somebody who is data-driven, who likes lots of information, and they're not going to make a decision on your deal anytime soon. They're far slower paced. They like the research. They like to look at the facts and figures and the data. Whereas other people, they can make a decision in 20 seconds because they're fast paced, fast talking, intuition guided. But again, you might miss that if you're not really truly listening. So by listening, you can pick up these things. And again, it comes back to that sensory acuity of really looking to, okay, what is driving this person? How do they see the world? What are their beliefs? What are their values? What are they signposting to you about what's important for them?
I like that. Level 5 listening. It's like the highest level, and on the opposite end is probably just hearing, the physical act of hearing, which is just, you know, not really mental and cognitive. So that's fantastic. You've been through many crises, and obviously we talked about negotiation, but crises and crisis communications is slightly different. It's a different field, which I'm very interested in, very active in as well. And I wonder, I mean, one of the ideas from the book that I really took away was that there's often a crisis within a crisis. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, the crisis within the crisis. I would say about 80% of my time on a kidnapping case would be spent dealing with my own client. Would be with the family or the company of which the hostage got taken from. Dealing with the kidnappers was relatively easy and straightforward. They're businessmen, they want to get a good deal, but most of the challenge was on my own side. And so the crisis within the crisis is where, as I mentioned at the beginning, egos, internal politics, competing demands, conflicting priorities, silo thinking, all of these things would come into play, and that's where most of my focus was needed. And this applies now to everyday business negotiations. People will find that dealing with the client or the customer, it's relatively straightforward. They have some money or another product or service, and you have some money or product or service, and you're going to do an exchange. Relatively straightforward in the scheme of things. But how many times do our own internal systems and processes and procedures and people and hierarchies get in the way of really, truly effective customer or client service and adding value? And so time spent on managing the crisis within the crisis, again, you can apply the same bunch of fives to your own team, to your own side, to work out what and who is likely to get in the way here? What are the challenges? Who are the stars here? Who are the people who are going to really help us? And how do we manage this plethora of internal stakeholders? But again, they'll be driven by emotion, just like anyone else. And so time spent managing your own side is seldom wasted.
Yeah. There can be a lot of finger pointing in a crisis. Let's say there's been a cyber attack and customers' credit card data has been stolen, and, you know, people quickly move to pointing fingers at each other. How could this happen? And I think a good leader would just say, look, we were going to talk to them, we get to the bottom of all of this, but not now. Now our concern with our customers and our employees and doing the right thing, everything else we tackle later. So let's work together as a team.
It also works outside of a crisis situation. You know, so just in general, everyday business activity, dealing with the clients and the customers will be the easy bit, relatively speaking. But in any business systems and processes, the bottlenecks, the chokeholds, the obstacles will be internally on your own side, pretty much. And so, unless you can really oil that value chain, making sure those links in that value chain from start to finish are strong and are well-oiled and the processes there that really work, something is going to break and ultimately the client and the customer is going to suffer.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it is often in the planning and the preparation and the simulations that we, for instance, do with clients that you practice this also emotionally. So what we do in crisis simulations is to ensure that there's enough emotional pressure on the leadership team so they can really feel what it means and not just think about it rationally.
Yeah.
So what advice do you give to companies how to communicate during a crisis?
I think it's really important to have clarity of message, clarity of the narrative. Well, first of all, you've got to control it. And so what we used to do in a kidnapping, we used to say we want one voice, one number, and one message. One voice, one number, one message. So from our side, we want one person communicating on one phone number to one person on the other side with the kidnappers, and there's going to be one message from us to them, one voice, one narrative, one message, as opposed to lots and lots of different silos and different communication streams where everybody's interpreting it and inputting. And so we want to bring about having some kind of control over the communications. And that really brings around some clarity and focus. Okay, what is the message that we want to put across, and what is the best means of communicating that to whom? And for us, it would be usually a telephone message, a telephone call, or in a cyber, it would be via email or some kind of other encrypted means. But what we didn't have is four, five, or six people all adding their two pennies worth, all contributing at different levels, unless that was a deliberate part of the strategy. And so it's really about getting focused on what is the message, what do we want to say, how do we want to say it, and what is our desired impact from this message? What do we want the recipient to think, feel, and act upon receiving this message?
Yeah.
And that way it just prevents getting lost in the noise.
Yeah. And it's always a story, right? A crisis is an emerging story, and it's important who tells the story and who plays what role in that story.
Yeah, do you want it to be a thriller, adventure story, or do you want it to be a tragedy or a comedy of errors? I don't know.
Yeah, and you don't want to be the villain.
No, actually, that's interesting. In terms of a crisis, you have a short time span with which you're the victim, and people will forgive you. But unless you can handle it quickly and properly, and communicate it effectively, you become the villain very quickly. And a lot of companies, they can manage the operational effectiveness in a crisis very well, but they struggle to communicate. And as you know, being able to be operationally effective, but also communicate effectively, they're the two strands of really effective crisis management.
Well said. 100% agree. And that's also what we see. And this is where we are being brought in is on the communication side. And yeah, I often tell leaderships in those situations that make sure you're not the villain. Think about who the villain is and make sure you're not the villain. And sometimes it can be an external factor, a recession, a virus, it can be a victim of crime, like a cyber attack. But it is important to understand who is the villain in that narrative and who's... Also, you're not the hero usually, but that's for another day. Now, I wanted to ask you also about Scott the Speaker, because You write in your book, go in as Sherlock Holmes, not Gordon Gekko. And that's, of course, fantastic advice when it comes to negotiations and when it comes to crisis communication. So, you know, stay cool, analyze the situation and behave rationally and also understand the emotions, of course. But you're about to embark on a book tour in the US. So you will be on stage. You'll be speaking to a lot of people. And of course, there you have to inject a lot of emotion and a lot of, let's say, energy into your speech, into your keynote. So how do you think about that when you go on stage?
Yeah, well, great question. I generally get out of my own way. And what I mean by that is I have to put myself in the audience's shoes. If I go on stage thinking how I'm feeling, what I'm thinking, what's going on for me, I'm going to get in my own way. And ultimately, by the time I'm getting to about to step onto the stage, about to be introduced, that's not the time for me to learn or work out what I'm going to say. I've already done that ahead of time, hopefully. And so I already know what my ultimate outcome, just like what we're just talking about. I know already what I want the audience to think, feel, or act differently at the end of the talk. I want them to be able to walk away from that talk immediately being able to apply some tools, techniques, strategies, new ways of looking at things, insights. Because I already know what they're going to be, it means I can then meet that audience where they are at. Because as you know yourself, every audience is different. And I could say the same line in 100 different talks and it's going to land differently each time. But because I know what I'm going to say, it also gives me the ability to be agile and flexible in the moment, that if I'm sensing either something isn't resonating or I need to change the style of how I'm communicating it, or actually something which I thought was a passing comment actually gets a bit of traction, there's some questions on it, I can see there's a really positive, warm engagement by the audience to that comment, then I might elaborate on that a bit more. So it's having the confidence and the courage to almost dance with the audience. It's that cooperation and collaboration again I mentioned at the beginning about what a negotiation is, and that's no different from doing a keynote talk or a fireside. It's being really truly present. I mean, like, properly present with that sensory acuity, working out what is the energy in the room? I have to be able to reach the person, the 3,000th person, the very back, just as much as the person who's in the front row. It's being able to convey that, work out where they're at, and being able to adapt that communication style and the message accordingly. All of this is happening in split seconds, as you know.
Yes.
And yeah, that's how I approach it.
Dance with the audience. I really like that. I never heard that. And I would say that as a speaker, you choose the music. Mm. And it's just like that. That's a fantastic metaphor to dance with the audience.
Because I think with that, you've only got to, we're just talking about hero or villain in a crisis. When you walk out on stage, you've got seconds for the audience to trust you. And they need to be able to trust you really, really quickly. And once you've worked hard to establish that, you then need to keep it and keep that rapport. And again, that is no different to negotiation, because trust is the number one success factor in all negotiations, particularly in kidnapping, because that's why there's a 93% chance of success of hostages coming back through negotiation. 93% in the most
stunning,
ungoverned, unregulated, dangerous industry in the world, there's a really high success rate because we spend the time establishing trust, doing empathy, validating, making the side feel seen, heard, and understood. And then you've built up the trust, which then, and this is a crucial bit, you then earn the right to then influence and persuade. Just like you do in a keynote where you've earned the trust, you've built the trust, you've earned the right to then influence and persuade through stories with the audience to take them on a journey to get to a place where they walk away thinking, not only was that really interesting and informative, but actually that was really good fun. And now my life is better as a direct result.
Yeah, that's the ideal outcome. I think a lot of people go on stage or present and say, oh, I'm important. I've done these things. So please trust me. I assume you do it differently. So how do you establish trust in the first few seconds on stage?
Yeah, the fact that I'm on stage in the first place at that event means you've already got an element of credibility there. And usually in the bio, it's a bit of your background is there. Because if I walk on, or if you walk on, or somebody goes on and says, yeah, I've made $10 million in the last 2 years and I've bought and sold 6 startups, or I've negotiated 3.5 million kidnappings or whatever it is, people are going to, okay, great hotshot. Yeah, but so what? And so again, it's, you've got to get people to go me too, as opposed to so what. Mm. So it's about really, again, the same thing in negotiation is, I want to be able in the opening of my talk is to make the audience feel seen, heard and understood. Scott understands where we're at, what our industry is going through right now, the challenges in our sector, or for this particular company, or some wins. And so if I can identify that as part of the opening, I'm slowly starting to warm to the audience, or they're going to warm to me. They're going to think, actually, Scott knows what our pain points are. And actually, this is going to be interesting, because now he's actually saying, well, these are your pain points. Is that right? Yes, absolutely. They're our pain points. And actually, where do you want to get to? And paint a picture of the empowering future. And then actually, well, the reason I can help you with that is because of my background. I then can start to bring that in. And then I take them on the journey using stories and metaphors and key principles to get them to where they need to get to.
Yeah, that's amazing. You want the audience to say, me too, not so what.
Yeah.
That is a big insight, a big takeaway. Thank you, Scott. So we established there's a lot of overlap between what we do on the business side, the negotiation, the crisis communications, and what you've done in your previous life as a kitten forensic negotiator. But are there any crucial differences?
I think the only, in terms of approaching the negotiation, no. As I said to you, you've got to deal with the emotion first. People are just looking to get the best deal. People won't agree to the best deal unless they feel seen, heard and understood. It's about trust, and it's about seeking some kind of cooperation and collaboration. You know, you can always maybe achieve quickly by yourself, but you go further together. And it is about reputation and about likability as well. Never underestimate the power of likability, regardless of the negotiation you're in. I guess the only real difference was we couldn't afford to walk away from a negotiation when we're dealing with kidnappers or hostage takers. Whereas in the business world, you can if you have to. But even what we could still do is, if it was starting to spiral a bit out of control, things weren't working out the way we wanted to, we could take a time out. We could go, do you know what? We're going to come back tomorrow. Let's end the conversation now. We're going to have 24 hours and we'll speak to you tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so you can build that firewall, and you can build that buffering where you can get some exercise, some food, some fresh air, and start again.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe that in a business context, you want maybe to build a lifelong relationship with a customer, whereas in the kidnap case, you hopefully never see that person or speak to that person again. Is that a does that influence the process somehow?
But we still could take months in that negotiation with the kidnappers. So if it's going to be done in 24 hours and we're never going to see them again, that's going to be slightly different. But if I've got to speak to this person day in, day out for 6 months and lives on the line, I need to treat them like a client for life. And people will go, how can you treat kidnappers like that? They're subhuman, they're bad people. I'm like, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you, but if I don't make them feel seen, heard and understood and acknowledge what they're feeling and their emotions, they ain't gonna buy into this long term.
Right.
Straightforward as that. And yes, we do have some of the kidnappers coming back time and time again, and they're very professional. They look after the hostages, and certain parts of the world I've ended up being involved in negotiations two or three times with the same group each time.
So they have a reputation too, and oh yeah, you can do business with them. They release the hostages.
Yeah.
Jeez, I'd never thought about that. Yeah. Wow. Scott, this has been fun and really informative, and this was a real dance with me and the audience. I appreciate it, man. And where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, on there, and the website, scottwalkerbooks.co.uk, and people can find out more about the book there, as well as some of the negotiation workshops and keynotes that I do as well.
Great. And we link to that in the show notes, of course. And this is always my final question. What's your best piece of communications advice?
I'd like to take credit for it, but it's not mine. But it applies to every conversation and communication you could ever have, which is seek first to understand before being understood.
Yes. I like that. I think it was it Teddy Roosevelt?
Maybe.
Something along those lines. We establish that later. Scott, thank you. That was amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you very much indeed.
And see you all next week.